So, yeah, we're not in control over the next thing out of our mouth. Is that a problematic statement?
Today, I'm feeling problematic.
Right, and you know, you could argue against that to some extent and say, well, but I intend to say something, you know. And in fact, sometimes there's a kind of counterexample that I guess the exception that proves the rule. Sometimes somebody else is speaking and you're thinking about what you're going to say in response, and so you plan it out and you say 1, 2, 3. So you've kind of got your outline, but even then, when you actually open your mouth to start speaking, you know, unless you are in a situation that I've just read about in novels, where you plan your rejoinder, you know, or in retrospect, we say, well, I should have said, oh, yeah.
Where I'm thinking of refining my position is that it seems like there's a choice about whether one,
whether one speaks at all.
Starts to speak, right. What it actually is that comes out, then it's like, it's not totally unpredictable. I mean, it's not like, because I'm intending to say something related to this topic, I'm just starting to talk about spaceships or something.
Right, right. It's not totally unpredictable, but it's predictable in the sense that it's a response to what's going on in the room and in the conversation. And in fact, something along those lines seems to be the alternative to the self being in control. You know, if you are open to the possibility of being responsive to what's going on in the situation, and of course we have to say you are responsible, you know, you are open and you are responsive, that's how we say these things, and that's how we, you know, it's our kind of basic assumption. But the idea of responsiveness is different from responsibility, at least in the sense of, you know, if you say, who said that? You say, well, I said it. Okay, so you're taking responsibility. But you're not taking responsibility for each and every word. You can't. The self is not able to do that.
It's kind of an interesting, the way I was visualizing it when you said it is that you're right. When you're in the process of speaking, you're in a process, and the self may have sent you, given the initial intention to send you on that little journey, but then it can only sort of be back there watching it as you know, as you go forth with whatever words flow into your mind.
Do you know what's really funny about that? Because when you first said it, I sort of was like, of course you know what you're going to say before you say it. And then I thought about singing, which, so when I sing, when I used to sing and perform, if I was reaching for the words and trying to control the experience, very often they were not there. And if I let go and didn't try to know what the next word was, it was almost always there. Which sounds exactly like what you're saying. And that's really weird because that's even scripted, right? The words are already written.
Right.
And I, you know, presumably I know what they are because I've, you know, practiced them. But if I think about knowing what they are, I invariably can't find them all. But if I stop, then they just come. Yeah. I mean, at first I had to choose to let go, and then that became the way that I did it. I stopped reaching.
But that is an interesting example. So I've sat on that screen so where you're singing, and yeah, if you really concentrate, you tend to get choked up in it. But if you just kind of relax, go with the process of singing, it seems to be.
Or a similar example. I know Bruce, you wanted to say something, but a similar example that I have noticed many times is, if you have a text memorized, like a prayer, for instance, and you say, well, you know, like it says in the third line of the prayer, well, you can't go there, right? You have to start from the beginning and get to that point. You know?
Yeah.
So, Bruce?
I was just thinking along these lines as I used to, watching thought and thinking about this, and just, you know, somebody poses something to you, like, think of a South American animal.
Mm-hmm.
Is the self in charge of what animal pops in my mind? Or think of a color. Is the self really in charge? The self can appropriate it afterwards, but I can say, I did not have the entire, you know, range of options, and then I carefully deliberated it's like it pops in there, you know, and then self kind of appropriates it. But so it seems to be that even on that operation of choosing something, there's a doesn't seem to be the control that I, you know, kind of retrospectively think is is there.
Mm-hmm. It's a good example because it suggests to me, if I think about that example, I actually realized I couldn't think of a South American animal. A llama, very good, thank you.
It's a good example because you can't.
Right.
Kangaroo? No.
Yes. Right. It's funny. I had that. Right.
Lots of trees.
Right. Then I thought panda. And I thought, no. It's right here. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway, no. But it's interesting because it takes you a moment or longer, as we've seen, to think of something, and right along with the thinking of that something comes the kind of identifier that says, I'm the one who thought of that.
Yeah.
But it doesn't, it's not there first.
It's not fast enough to follow what's
mm-hmm.
being said.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, to be controlling what's being
mm-hmm.
said.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a heretical thought for the morning. It's only the fourth or fifth, so don't worry. I'm wondering if your comment on this, our discussion, is controlled by the self already, so that we're quickly taking a position, oh, we do agree or we don't agree,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and that we're already polarized and, you know, struggling with, well, what is it?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm struck by how much more so it is, you know, whether it's fast enough or slow enough or the right thing, that the social behavior that starts to influence which position we take and something. So I don't feel yet like we're in the place of actually, I don't know, as a group, maybe exploring it. And I don't know exactly what the terms of that are. I don't have any information, you know, but I feel cautious that we're already into the mode that it's quick that we take position, and whether it's based on power or
experience.
Well, maybe, I don't know. I don't feel yet any experience happening.
Mm-hmm.
I feel my mind
mm-hmm.
busy moving around the room. Well, she thinks and he thinks and that one does and this one does and this
mm-hmm.
one agrees.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, but I'm not wherever I think I'm, you know, being encouraged to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know what that is. I don't know if that's true. I'm just saying this is where I'm plugging
mm-hmm.
into this.
Well, I think that what you say is true, and I think what Cecilia says is also true, that that when we talk about this and we agree, you know, these things are really very complicated. So if you wind up talking about them, then the tendency is to add a layer of complication, and that doesn't help too much. But still, let's try. If we're talking about this, one possibility is we agree. And we agree on the basis of things we've already thought about or things we've read about in the TSK books or somewhere else,
mm-hmm.
or maybe memories we have. That's also a possibility, right?
Or the zeitgeist.
Yeah, right. Okay. That sort of thought we've had. Maybe it's not our thought, but the zeitgeist thought. But,
yeah.
A meme, as they say nowadays.
A what?
A meme. Let's not go there. Sorry.
Let's
So that's one possibility, is we agree. in itself, that probably doesn't help too much. It reinforces something that we already subscribe to, right? And it doesn't seem to advance things very much. Another possibility is that we say something like this, and it's an invitation. And that's how I think about thoughts and words a lot, but especially thoughts, I guess, is that we tell a story. It's more like a story is how I think about it. You tell this story and you say, well, the self is not in control of what it says. And we shouldn't forget that this came out of a broader issue, which is the self is not in control of vast stretches of experience, or maybe the whole thing, but we've kind of zeroed in on words and saying. So that's an invitation, it's a new thought. And it invites us to consider whether that's the case. And then the question is, how can you consider that? And then you say, well, let's look into it. So it's a very natural invitation to say, well, let's explore it. And to some extent, we were doing that. It's what I said before. This is a fascinating example to me because while you're talking about it, you're also doing it. So you have a chance to see, are the words that are coming out owned by the self or, prepared in advance by the self or chosen by the self? And it really seems to me pretty clear, and as I speak, that they're not. If I really try to focus in a different way, maybe I could imagine that like a tenth of a second before I say the word is there. But I'm not sure that's right. That would be worth exploring. But anyway, one possibility is to explore it in this case while you're speaking. The broader possibility would be to say, okay, we have a new thought here, a new possibility, a new exercise. Really, there's the exercises in the TSK book, or the TSK books, but then there's all sorts of exercises which are really more like explorations. The other day somebody said inner size, I guess. And I didn't like that too much, but since then I've been thinking about a word other than exercise, and I thought, well, a creative inquiry. That creative inquiry number one. Doesn't sound so... Well, let me just finish, and I know this is complicated, I'm sorry. But you start with the experience. There's this invitation. Then you say, okay, let's explore through experience. Now, when you explore through experience, all of those same structures come in to condition your experience. And so in the beginning, what you're exploring is not really very helpful. It's just another version of what you already know. So you have to be able to go through the first layer of experience. And there are many, many ways to do that. You can do it through getting more in contact with feelings in the body, or you can do it by being willing to unknow, or you can do it by looking in the directions you don't usually look in, and space and time provide many examples of that. So experience in itself is not such a great guide, but dropping down into a more creative form of experiencing, which may well include the experience of having our usual experience, right? The kind of a meta level of experience. That's where you would investigate this. So just talking about it and just all nodding and agreeing, I think you're right, doesn't get us very far, but it is an invitation. And the question is, how can we take it up? And one question for us this morning might be, shall we take this up instead of what I thought we were going to do, which is fine with me if that's where we go. Okay, Tina, you were going to...
Yeah, interesting. Seems to me like, and it might be true, stating that the self is not in control, well, that assumes we actually know what the self is. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure we do.
Well, I'm not sure you have to assume that either. Maybe you do. But what if you just say, well, I don't know what a self is, but if I look around for it in terms of someone or entity or identity that is in control, I don't find one of those. Kind of leaving it open what it is. Do you think that would work?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can I just go back to Lois's point, which I might have misunderstood, but what I thought she was saying is that we were taking this exploration of the self, not being in control, and that exploration was reinforcing a sense of self. And then my thought was, well, one way to avoid doing that is maybe to do the sort of the speaker things, or to sort of continue the level of abstraction from the self when talking about the experience, which is one of the ways you said that we could we could do that. And that maybe that's a way, if we more consciously did it, of deepening the experience of trying to find the self or identify where we get attached to the self. I don't know.
Okay, so I, that sounded similar to what I was saying, but maybe you thought I was... Go ahead.
Yeah, I think what I heard you say was something around... what this speaker heard you say. was more that we dove into the experience from our usual way of experiencing, which I sort of understood to be from the self. So we all... you know, pretty much started from I had this experience, or I thought this, or when you said I, you know, like we all went right there.
Right.
And so that was kind of when I was listening to Lois, that's what I kind of took away from what she was saying, was that we all went to a strongly defined self, and that conversation reinforced that strongly defined self. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand what you, when you said our ordinary experience, I just kind of assumed that diving into the strong sense of self was what you were referring to as our ordinary experience.
Yeah, pretty much. I think that's right. You could... Yeah, basically, yes.
One distinction, it seems like there's, even if we're talking from the self, about the self, that at least seems like it's a step past sitting here talking about the weather, or whatever, and not trying to pay attention to that. So that's at least... moving a step towards thinking about it, but I agree, it's like we're still in what we're all saying, most of saying in the self mode, and then how do you take it? I don't know, I don't know about what the levels are, if that's level one, but then the level two or level three is like trying to get to a different sense, and that's what's challenging. So I think even just at least using language the way we typically do automatically propels us there. The little experiment you gave us to not use I sort of threw a wrench into that, so you had this. Start being aware of, oh, I'm saying I. So if I say the speaker or something else, I'm trying to have some awareness of who's speaking, that even though I, the speaker, is still using words, he's thinking about what's happening. But then it goes a bit, I agree with what you're saying, because it's how do you get to the next level, that's level two. Or,
I don't think you get to the next level so conceptually.
No, you don't. That's
what
right.
What you're doing is conceptualizing along. Okay, level one, level two, level three, sub level da da da. And so it's. I think it's
something different.
Yeah, and being a little surprised by what's different. What you were saying, Kathleen, before. You were in some space thing and you got a little dizzy and you got off-centered from your usual whatever experience, and that surprised you, and you said, well, did you like it, or was it have some positive yes? And so I don't even know if it's a question of like or dislike or pleasure or indifference. Mm-hmm. We're not supposed to say, okay, this was a good one, this was a bad one, and this we should follow this. So I think it's a little more like deep sea diving. You don't know what you're going to find. And I think you're right, what you said is, Jack, about you have to proceed. And better to proceed than not to proceed. Mm-hmm. And it's going to take time. And just doing one exercise, number 20, doesn't say, okay, I've got that one. Now we're going to level 21.
That's what I meant by experience.
Yes.
It's just that you have to do it. And not, that it's really good you're saying exactly where you are right now. And that's part of being able to move on.
Right.
Being clear so that later when you do have different experience, you'll know.
Yeah, you can identify the
experience just repetition of
practice. There's just one thing, and I think that's what gets me, is that we're so quick to grab on to something. I'm a yoga. You said it the other day. I'm a yoga practitioner. You know, I took one class in yoga. Let's do this. I'm a meditator. You know,
right.
It's like labeling that so much, and for me, it stops me from going
mm-hmm.
wherever we're trying to go or
mm-hmm.
thinking about going or contemplating.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
yeah, that's interesting. Now I hope it happens again tomorrow.
But it won't.
But it probably won't.
Right.
Whenever. But maybe I'll be more open to a different response rather than saying, "Oh, this is bad." Oh.
That's right. Well, even when you said I didn't pass out, I passed out and. Not so bad. I think something came back. Shedding that skin that I carry around and want to carry around because it's comforting and secure.
Okay, well, let me suggest that we should explore this, you know, in a realm that goes perhaps beyond the conceptual. And we already did a practice a few days ago that is along these lines, and that was exercise 5 in Love of Knowledge, the disowning tension, it's called. You remember the suggestion there was not to kind of pretend that the self, that there's no self, well, I shouldn't say pretend, but not to just, the exercise does not say there's no self. The exercise says, consider the self as part of what's given in the situation. And that does go directly to this point that we've been talking about, which is the self is not the owner, the self is not the one in control, although I suppose it could be given as the owner or in control, it's possible.
Tenants in common.
Right. It has certain visitation rights or something.
Yes. Well, are we saying, are we putting a label on what we think is in control?
Well, that's something to look at. Is there something in control? That's a question to ask, perhaps. So my suggestion is let's do a practice, which will be one of these very open practices where people just stop talking and sit for a while and then they start talking again. So two things. One is you could think about that model of you know, taking the self as part of what's given in the situation. There is another practice which... I'm doing a little bit of a disservice to by introducing it casually, but you might want to explore it. That's called the object and its glow, that many of you know. And the basic idea there is to say, if you imagine a luminous object, a cactus flower is the example that's given, it gives off a glow. I always think of a candle, actually, and the what do you call it? The penumbra? Is that the penumbra of the candle? But the point is, there is the object, and then there is the glow, and you could think of the self as being like the glow, instead of, again, being the one who's outside manipulating or owning or commenting or having thoughts about. So those two exercises are quite similar to each other. And you can do that practice with respect to anything that's going on in your experience. And you could also try to manipulate your experience, you know, and say, now I'm going to have a thought. You know, now I'm going to think. Maybe that's a better way to say it. So what happens when I think? Or, you know, now I'm going to attend to feelings in the body, whatever it is. And let me make one suggestion. Let's do that. We'll sit for about 20 minutes and explore that. And then my suggestion is that when we have done that, when I say okay, which is what I usually say, maybe I should say something different. When I say okay at the end, and we invite conversation about it, that we continue the practice in the conversation, or have that as an intention. So okay doesn't really mean end of practice, it means shift in practice.
So we continue to put the self in the given.
Right. Okay. We can right. In the conversation.
Is object and its glow in TSK, the first line?
Yes, it is. It's, I would guess, about 28 or 29, but I'd have to look
so
it
now
up.
Are we doing both those practices?
Well, I'm just giving you, well, you could think about it that way. I think those are two descriptions of a practice that boils down to about the same thing, but maybe I'm missing some subtlety there.
Yeah, because I'm thinking on the strobe light.
The strobe light. That introduces a lot of complexity.
Somebody has a very positive reaction to the a connotation of penumbra being a positive experience.
Mm-hmm.
And when you gave said the self was the penumbra, I got all upset because the object
mm-hmm.
felt like the self, and the penumbra felt like what spreads out, what's more diaphanous, what goes further, and the self is like being confined. But
mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe I got the exercise wrong.
Well, the description, you know, just if you just do it the way, if you look at the description the way you just described it, then it seems like you're saying the self is the solid thing in the middle, and that sense of solidity is a little problematic.
Except, but I felt like personally, just
mm-hmm.
could drop that
mm-hmm.
more easily than the penumbra was more inviting to me. Like
mm-hmm.
it could go anywhere. But
okay.
I understand what you're saying.
Right.
So as long as I'm clarifying, it doesn't matter.
Right. And, you know, in this kind of a practice, I think, and in this, you know, in creative inquiry in general, or exploring the TSK vision, you know, any story, any metaphor, any description that helps you question what we ordinarily take for granted is fine. It kind of helps if we have a common vocabulary, but if we're careful, we don't even need that. So let's do this practice for 20 minutes. Maybe 25 minutes. Okay. So I left out the part about writing something, but that might be fruitful. Let's take a few minutes. Okay, let's take just a minute more. Okay, so we want to continue the inquiry, the exercise. I was thinking of the word inquest, but that has a pretty technical meaning, the inquest. As we share some of our observations, experiences, questions, etc. So who would like to say something?
Instead of using the word I or giving a personal report, might be interesting just to go over a couple of the lines of inquiry, just voicing them as a statement or a question.
You're suggesting that as a procedure that we follow?
For myself.
For yourself.
And so, starting first with the object and its glow exercise, imagining a luminous flower with glow, and having a hard time getting that cactus flower or whatever to be right there, so bringing to mind the avatar moving through the bioluminescent forest and looking at the bioluminescent flowers and just feeling the solidity of the object and the luminous quality around it. How is that luminous quality like the self? Merging that glow with that feeling of being an observer. So self is glow to object. Feeling self and object together, thinking of Jake running on the soil, and where every footprint hits, there's that glowing impression briefly and fading. How is the self like a brief glowing impression left by an event that's passing? So I'm watching the footprint and then a strong objection. No, self feels too solid. Self feels too much here, not just a passing, glowing impression. Then aha, look, that strong line of thought and objection is also a strong passing object, and self is or can be, what does it feel like if self is glow to that passing long line of strong objection? So objection moves from self to footprint in the soil. So opening the eyes and seeing the room. How are the objects related to the self? or self is the glow of object, seems that self and object are together. Self is inseparable from object, but somehow from that place, self is not interfering with the object because it's not at the center. There's a kind of feeling of joy in that experience. And then questioning, am I creating this? In this doing and undoing, what is really happening?
Who's saying who is really?
A strongly rising question.
To get to that space of periphery or the glow, which is not the ordinary space I come from or speak from, but since it was the practice and I know how to get there now, I did the two different practices of Vajrayana. And one is a deity that gives love and kindness to the universe, including our group here, which is outside of me, invoked in the center. And then one is another one that is sitting above my head and does some sort of cleansing. And in that process, at the end of it, there is some dialogue between the deity that I invoke above my head through my imagination and who I perceive as I. The certain dream that I had a couple of months ago has been in my mind and I keep writing on it. It dawned on me this morning that I had needed to let go of the guilt that I have of certain behaviors that I still feel guilty of from my childhood. And so this practice of, the second practice of the Vajrayana that I wanted to do to get to the glow space or the periphery of awareness, which is a lot looser and less condensed and solid, also address some of that dream and feeling the guilt and as if it's a letting go and forgiveness that from the deity is confirmed on me, which I'm imagining, and so it releases a lot of holding on the solidity. So then when I dissolve all this imagination, then it's this more free, less solid, more of that glow that is very, very dispersed and expansive. And then from that, what came up was the conversation that transpired between the group prior to the practice of the words. Sentences come up and the meaning try to convey. And it seemed from that space and that state of awareness, it words are just hope to connect to some logic, to be noticed, and it appeared or dawned on me that in the state of silence, rather that can also happen. So I have one teacher at Institute. He always says, in that space of silence, you can convey so much more and stronger, in stronger frequency, or meaning transferring what you want to convey. And that felt very true. Looking at our conversations of this morning and how conceptual words and how the eye doesn't really control it, but then what does it really happen? What do we do? So some of that came up, and then I sat in the not in puzzlement, but the question of then how could then ever be in silence be certain of the others. Detail for state that they occupy in that moment. That is perhaps very difficult for me.
Thinking so much of the glow as when we did an exercise, I'm losing track of time, is it yesterday or the day before, of the edges, and seeing that there are no edges, and, which I was told in art school many, many years ago, and couldn't ever make sense of, but it's true. See now, much there, and no edges at all in thoughts. Appearances, emotions. So when we were walking through the forest, when we were in the redwood circle and then in the forest, all the unbelievable, I could stop for an hour in any square yard and look. And that's true anywhere, even internally, but how beautiful they've always seemed to me, all the texture, even in this floor, all the texture and the color and the richness of form. And it's true, if I can accept that in the forest floor, why can't I accept that in my thoughts and emotions as well? And also, so I'm, you know, looking at the cow pies too, saying, are they beautiful? But then, so the self could just be one of the leaves or just one of the buds in, and just as in that edge exercise, just feel good when that's the case. It actually is very, the self is more content when it's not charged with being in charge of everything. So then when we're looking at the grasses blowing in the wind, same thing. just you're there and you're all there together. It just feels bad. And it's more true. I don't know why I keep forgetting.
Looking southwards, it seemed natural to me to look at, to look in a temporal mode, the object and its glow, or, you know, suggest a kind of physical, the spatial mode, but consistent with some of what we were talking about before we did the practice, it seemed to me that when I looked for the self, it came up afterwards. There was an experience, and then the self making sense of it. And that shaped the next experience, and so presumably the previous experience also. But looking more carefully, there was not such a strong, there was not a owner self, you could say, much more of a narrator self and a narrated self. And that was in my experience during the practice. But now, as people have been speaking, that's very different. It's not the same in each case, but I've been listening, and the initial move is to listen as a self. And that involves judgment and liking and disliking and accepting and appreciating or rejecting or differentiating, those kinds of reactions. And if I'm aware of those reactions, or as I become more aware of those reactions, then a different way of experiencing the one who's speaking is available, and it's much more intimate. That's all.
In the exercise. I don't know if I did exercise the way we're supposed to, but what I have is just how difficult it is, what I can live with, how difficult it is. But I had an image of, it's like trying to look at my face or at my eyes, and you can't do that with your eyes. But it felt like that's what I was trying to do, and it was like creating something a little different because of that, but I didn't feel like I could do it. Experiencing how my thinking seemed to be happening in my head, and I was thinking, well, why does it seem like it seems to be happening there as opposed to someplace else? And I was just thinking how all my senses except sensation are in my head, eyes and ears and taste and smell. So it was just an interesting thought, and I was thinking, but that sensation is, not just in my head. That's interesting. Then I just imagine what would be like to be thinking from my stomach. Mm. And that sort of made me think of the chakra system and that, which I don't tend to get into that much. But what if I imagine myself thinking from there instead of what I usually feel like thinking from my head? And that was also interesting. Just a different perception. Jack, I was really touched by what you said at the end about the intimacy. I also feel that, and I appreciated you saying that because it felt like an intimate statement. So that's coming from my self, I think, but it's felt appreciated.
Let's take our break. So 11:25 back here.
In the past 2 days, I've had this really, this recurring memory that keeps coming in, and it seems to be connected with the self. When I was 20 years, I had several moments where
I was at work, and I was fully awake, and I suddenly was observing myself from a higher position and seeing myself, and I had this realization that this was not the way I wanted to behave. And I mean, that was the ultimate like realization, but that experience of being away from myself, is that the self-separating? Is that I mean, I was fully aware of, of being there. I can remember what I was wearing. It wasn't a flashback. I didn't do drugs, so and I remember actually thinking that at that moment, oh, this is a flashback or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized, well, you know, that can't be. And it was really a, and I never ever said anything to anybody about it because who would, I didn't think it was nuts. So I'm just curious, is that something with the self that is occurring, or I'm loosening and allowing a different observation?
I think it's a different kind of knowing.
Uh-huh.
It's not the self's usual knowing. Something is knowing that is not the usual self.
Uh-huh. Okay. So it's more a knowing.
As opposed to what?
No, I guess that makes. Yeah. It's just. I. How must I do these things? You know, I'm so body centric. I'm so, like. And when I. Kind of move away from my body.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the self's hanging on really tight to that.
Were you scared by that experience?
Not at all. I mean, I was appalled.
At what you saw?
Yeah.
Yeah.
At what I saw.
That's different. Yeah.
Yeah. And it was a defining moment in my life to make a change. And then, of course, I did make a concerted effort and stayed pretty aware, but there was still the trappings, and there's a gazillion other things that need to change as well.
Sure.
But that was a very, that was a really, really profound moment, and it was so different than, other than in childhood, most of my adult experience. I mean, I had never experienced that before.
Right. So when I said that was a knowing, and then you said, but I'm so body-centric, I don't understand how those two things fit together.
I guess I don't either. That's one of those situations where the words came out and
uh-huh.
I had no control. I don't know.
Well, so knowing... You know this. Knowing is not, it doesn't have to be separating from the body.
Right.
You know, the body knows.
I guess that's part of it. I have a very difficult time not making the self the center of everything. And the self knows in my
mm-hmm.
self,
mm-hmm.
and how I perceive myself.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm outside of that, it's no longer for me.
Mm-hmm.
The self, and I guess there is that part of me that I kind of inherently know exists, that it has kind of that ability to recognize things that this doesn't
mm-hmm.
in its current
mm-hmm.
content and form and
mm-hmm.
pattern base.
Mm-hmm. So, I was actually thinking about this during the practice. I was thinking, I'm not body-centric. I'm really not.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a pretty conceptual guy.
Mm-hmm.
I was thinking about Jung's four types,
mm-hmm.
that show up in the Myers-Briggs scale.
Yes,
theory.
Yes.
So that's a good place for you to look, That's the right place to be doing inquiry. It's
mm-hmm.
and through the body.
Okay. So like when I was up, when I had that happen today, you know, and I'm still kind of there a little bit. I'm still kind of, seems like there's this energy going on outside and inside, and it's not synchronizing.
Okay. So is that an uncomfortable place to be?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's okay. So the discomfort is part of it too. You ought to, if you get a chance, you might, if you don't mind, you might talk to Doug Nuremberg about the experience you just described.
Oh, really?
Because he had a very similar experience.
Really?
He hasn't described, this is kind of a long story, I mean, I'll let him tell the story. He's never mentioned it to me, but I actually saw it described in a newspaper story once.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it was his experience, you know. So you might ask him about it if you get a chance.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah, this ain't for wimps.
But you know, I really think it's nice how people are being very responsive.
Yeah,
people.
I do
yeah.
too.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's yes, it is. It's great.
It's inspiring. And motivating.
Motivate.
Sometimes I have the sense of wanting to run away.
Do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
But I keep coming back.
But you keep coming back.
Thank you. pretty sure it is in the introduction of one of the books. I'll have to find it then.
What about
He did say something
in there. Many Buddhists have asked me why I such and such. He did say something like that in one of the books.
I think it was more to not just Buddhists, but masters of Buddhism.
Yeah,
were questioning
something like that. He says,
"Yeah, why are you doing this? Why not just stick with Buddhism?" Yeah, that's true. I remember that passage, but I didn't read it as being, you know, a strong sense of criticism. Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's also said, you know, people sometimes say to him, Tibetan Buddhists, they say, well, why are you wasting your time in America? I mean, those people are barbarians. You know? Why don't you come back here and do something valuable? You know?
The Americans are barbarians?
Yeah. So people always said, somebody, when he writes somewhere that when he had decided to go to the West and he went first to Europe and traveled around a little in France, they said, why don't you stay here? And he said, no, I've decided really I should go to America. He said, why would you want to go to America? They're all barbarians. You know? Europe has culture.
Getting the sheep together, he seeks to see the lost. So many barbarians are lost.
Right, right. Barbarians need a little knowledge.
Yeah, we need
such a great opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And need. The need is great. The need is. Well, maybe since we're kind of talking about, not exactly, but kind of talking about it, maybe I'll just read you the first lines of this member I mentioned to you the other day. If you haven't had a chance to look at it, there's like 3 pages, a little more, where he talks about how, as he says here, the ways in which TSK studies differ from other approaches to knowledge. So just kind of the topic sentence of these different paragraphs.
Is that in Sacred Dimensions?
No, it's in Dimensions of Thought.
Dynamics.
The Dynamics of Thought, sorry. So, TSK does not put forward claims regarding an absolute. TSK does not maintain the existence of a creator or creative force responsible for appearance. TSK does not teach faith in any outside force, nor does it counsel devotion toward a higher being, such as God or the Buddha. TSK does not pursue knowledge through beliefs founded on reasons. TSK does not investigate a subject located somewhere else apart from the self. TSK follows no model or doctrine. TSK does not structure reality in terms of a hierarchy that proceeds from higher to lower or good to bad. TSK does not offer any moral code. TSK does not rely on prayers or ceremonies, nor does it ask anyone to make offerings or practice the accumulation of merit. TSK does not rely on worship. There is no path in TSK, no from or to, or going from one to the next. TSK relies on no higher authority apart from knowledge itself. TSK does not require attacking the positions or beliefs or attitudes of the ego. TSK does not assign guilt or define rules that are not to be broken. TSK does not directly teach the practice of love or compassion toward others. TSK does not separate the real from the fictional in any ultimate sense. TSK does not emphasize good works or benefiting others through acts of charity. And actually, since I've read that, I want to go on just a little bit, because it's an interesting list, it seems to me, that he says. It may seem from this list that TSK is hostile to systems of belief that make claims about reality or proper forms of conduct. But this conclusion would only limit the vision. Devotions and rituals do not belong to the TSK vision, but they do not contradict it. The path of religion can open to knowledge, and so can the path of science. Nothing in the vision precludes drawing on such traditions and approaches. For this reason, I have no special quarrel with readers who insist that the TSK vision is really a form of mysticism or meditative practice or disguised Buddhism. This is not my understanding, but others can offer their own interpretations. The vision itself is not affected by characterizations. Only when such interpretations turn into dogma will they restrict the benefits that the vision has to offer. More important than any characterization is learning to make inquiry into a tool for understanding and a manifestation of knowledge. Without setting out to support some particular discipline or accomplish a particular goal, we can transform our ways of understanding, of thinking, and of being. We can develop an intimacy with time, space, and knowledge, with consequences that will show up clearly in our lives. One of the nice things about the TSK books is that you can pick up and start reading almost anywhere, and you just say, wow.
What
page was that? Those were the little topic sentences are on pages Roman numeral 17 to 20, and then continuing on to page 21 from what I read afterwards.
I think the TSK vision celebrates the joy of being human more than any other
vision.
Well, any other thing I can think of, because in my mind, everything else limits that. Because it focuses on, well, Buddhism focuses on reincarnation and other lives, and Christianity focuses on the afterlife, and TSK focuses right, you know, on the living, on what are we doing right, you know, what are we doing, and even though it doesn't make a distinction between what is real or what is not real, there's clarity in that inquiry.
Yeah, clarity and inquiry. That's really the. That's it. Anything more from what we were doing this morning? I thought that was a very fruitful session and discussion. I was imagining maybe posting it online. Kathleen Gold's telling me we should have more online, you know. But that.
I'm posting
the discussion from this morning online. But it might be, you have to listen to it and see. Maybe things like that make sense in the context that they arise in, and then they may not make as much sense if you pull them out of that context. But I was thinking in the in those two books, which I edited, that came out at the same time, A New Kind of Knowledge and A New Way of Being, there are, I think, one in each book, there are transcripts of two retreat sessions that I was not involved in. Were you at those retreat sessions?
I wasn't.
Okay. But they're nice, I think. I found them interesting, so I mentioned them to you because you might like to look at them also. But this would be something like that, but because technology has advanced a little, it's easy enough to put them online just as the actual recording rather than having to transcribe them, because transcribing takes a lot of time, a lot of work. So.
Yeah, I'd actually like to put that excerpt on when we do it.
Which excerpt? The one we just looked at?
Yeah.
That might work.
Just so you know, I used to be a court reporter. And
oh, did you?
I have transcription equipment at my house.
Oh, you do.
Yeah. Well, Phil, but you knew how to do the actual, you know, they have those funny machines.
Yeah, no, I did it with the Dragon Systems voice thing. And
oh,
did
you?
With regular typing.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, interesting. Because court reporters.
You
have this very specialized way of
taking
notes.
Way.
Yeah. But okay, well, that's good to know. We have done a little transcribing work. Cecilia has done a little transcribing work. And we actually.
So much that I felt like I knew Russ when you talked about him, and I had to remind myself, you don't know Russ.
You just know what his voice sounds like.
It's really hard work.
Transcription?
I did like one day of a teacher, and it took me almost 2 weeks.
Really?
It was just,
yeah.
It was one day, full day.
Mm-hmm.
It was so much.
Yeah, people can say a lot in a short time. Right.
Alan Watts.
Oh, Alan Watts.
Mm.
It used to be a program that would be 15 minutes. Not Alan Watts on one of the New York public radio stations. 15 minutes of
Dharma. Mm-hmm. Good. He did a lot to help introduce people. Okay. What I thought we could do in the rest of our time this morning, let me turn this back on. What I thought we could do in the rest of our time this morning is work with an exercise from Dynamics that is certainly related to the conversations and the practice that we did this morning. I want to add a little something to it. I'll read you the description, and it's got three parts. So we'll do the first part for a while, and then we'll stop and do the second and third. Exercise 9. It's called Generating Space. So here's the first part. Sitting quietly, observe what is present and what is happening around you, noting how objects and events appear within dimensionalized space. So we're talking about what you might call physical space here. Focus your observation on characteristics of the sort that we usually connect to space. Start with the attribute of distance or separation. Separation between you and an object, the separation between two objects. He does talk about events, so you might say the separation in time, but that may be going a little beyond what he's saying here. So start with the attribute of distance or separation, then go on to such qualities as between or inside, and such phenomena, we already did this a little, as edges and borders. So this is a practice and observation. Initially, just become familiar with these elements of space dimensionality. Later, it'll be like 15 minutes, because we're moving quickly here. Later.
You can, yesterday's 15 minutes.
Later you can explore ways to open and loosen the categories you focus on so that they no longer function as firm distinctions. As such conventional space distinctions come under investigation, space itself becomes more spacious. You may notice that whatever you encounter in space shares in this newly spacious appearance. Observe what is present and what is happening, noting how objects and events appear within dimensionalized space. Focus on characteristics of the sort we usually connect to space: distance, separation, between, inside, edges, borders. You may have others. So, let's do that practice. okay. So now I want to extend that just a little. This isn't in the book, but it's related. As you focus on specific objects or events, expand the relevant field or your awareness of the field within which the object appears. So in other words, if you look at a table, that table is meaningful to you. And partly I'm talking about the realm of meaning. So the relation between you and the table, which is one of distance, is also one of connection. And both the distance and the connection are not just physical, but relate to meaning. Being in this room, you're inside the room, and the room, the roof, let's say, stretches out over you. And again, there's distance, there's separation, there's edges, there's all of that that we've been exploring. There's also the sense of it's a sheltering roof. It's a place in which we have been meeting together for days. So the range of meaning is a part of the field within which the object appears. It's very rare that we encounter something that's a pure pure shape that does not have meaning, maybe mathematical forms or too much else.
You're already attributing meaning to it?
I'm saying there is meaning. Whenever we encounter something, it has a meaning. Right? It's meaningful.
That is two layers out from the spatial experience of enclosing, containing.
So what's in between? What's the layer in between?
Well, I don't know if I would call it meaning, but I definitely agree there's something in between, but meaning feels like another thing.
Well, what I'm trying to point to is, maybe this is the layer in between, and you can move through it if you like, if this makes sense. Whatever object you engage in terms of its relationship in space or its being in space and its relationship to you is also part of a larger whole. You could take that inside. There's something inside it, but we're taking it outward, okay? So if you expand your sense of the presence of that object in space to the larger spatial whole, then that's maybe you could say one layer out.
Yeah.
And then the second layer out would be to say that whole has meaning, and that will open up then in more dimensions. You could do it in two steps. That might actually be a good idea, but we don't have very much time today in this session.
Could you also say might have meaning? Because you're attributing some significance. I haven't heard this before in the exercise, that it has meaning.
I'm saying it in a kind of in a way that I would imagine is pretty hard to question. You know, something is meaningful for you just in the sense, for instance, that you know what it is.
I don't mean
meaningful in the sense of significant.
Well, what?
Or there's independent meaning, it's in relation to us.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So, tables, holds, books.
Right.
We eat on
use?
One.
Go back to that word?
Yeah. Well, you could use the word use. That's one layer of meaning.
If you take that to another layer, where did the tape come from? A tree that gives shelter to the birds.
That also is a part of the meaning that one might discover. Yeah.
I think meaning for me is ambiguous because it starts to imply significance.
Yeah, I don't mean that.
Okay, so functionality is almost. Hey, that's too.
That's a little too limiting.
Yeah. But use.
Yeah.
It's almost like it has a story.
Yeah. Or another way to say it is it fits within a story.
Hmm.
Right.
Or multiple stories.
Multiple stories.
Infinite stories.
Right.
Okay.
Okay, give it a try anyway. We're not going to do it for very long. Okay. That's not very much time, but we're going to use that possibility we were exploring as a transition into another part of this exercise. So he's talking about this as a kind of dynamic. As he says at one point here, a spacious appearing rather than just space. And now he says, you can discover the same dynamic in the activity of thinking. Apply your inquiry, your investigation, you could say, to the experience of thinking, including associated feelings, images, and so forth, rather than simply to the content of what is experienced. You can also bring into the exercise the content and significance of each thought. In doing this practice, you may find that thoughts have a body that extends beyond their content, that the awareness of the mind and the openness of the heart are present as a kind of aura surrounding each thought.
That's funny, because that's what I did with the practice.
Is it? Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's where we're going. So, we're moving now. You can continue to focus on objects if you like, but as thoughts come up, the same dynamic of their appearing, and not just the content of the thought, but the activity of thinking, and not just the activity of thinking, but perhaps an aura of awareness or of the heart, a feeling that accompanies the thought. And this is a lot. We're moving pretty quickly here, so it's a lot. Let's see what you can do with it. Okay, let's stop there. You may want to make some notes. Take a couple of minutes to finish up. For those of you who have finished, you can keep doing the practice. course, then we have to write notes about that. And then Zeno. So, anyone like to share any thoughts, any concepts?
I have a problem. So.
Okay. Good.
It feels that when I do the expansion practices, specifically, especially these two that we did back to back. I sense that expansion, but then in the interim, I lose ground or I lose the sense of here and now. In the way that that towards the end, I had to go again to my body and start feeling the sensation on my legs. So I lose something. And I don't know if I can describe it, but it seems like there is a price I'm paying for having that. When objects lose their boundaries, let me describe it so you can maybe diagnose or see a little bit more. So for example, initially I started with this floor and it lost its boundary. I went into earth. My awareness went, and then to all sorts of beings that I imagined. I went further below, and on the other side there were other beings on earth, and then going the other way. So this expansion, it almost became some sort of an imaginary realm that I could, okay, I can imagine further and further, but I, when I come back here after that trip, then because the trip is over and it doesn't apply anymore to seeing things very expansively. With the thoughts in the same way, not getting into too much, I'm noticing the detail of it. Being like the aura outside of it, in a sense, so I don't get lost in the detail. It almost also seems like, okay, when that's over and I'm back to reality of this chair, this room, in this group, and this whatever roof, it's dissipated. It's shift. It's not like it can, I can maintain this some sort of connection, if it makes sense.
Did you want to say those?
Well, the speaker experience that is partially as being the point that the enlarging of the here now and the dissolving helps in what's going on here and now, and the experience of trying to hold on to it or make it work or make a connection is self-oriented in a way, and that the spatial experience enlarges everything so that you, one walks on a ground that is no ground, and that it's somehow okay. That's how I experienced it, and even particularly since this speaker saw the bodies, human bodies, as the source of this enlargement, or as the point of departure, things loosened up quite substantially, and this speaker did not experience loss at that, but I'm not sure that that's quote right or wrong. I didn't feel like loss.
May I?
Sure.
I've been playing with that too, dissolving the body, experimenting with that. And for me, for this speaker, that dissolving the scene, or trying to imagine myself simply as energy that takes no form, and then taking the room and the people in the room and the objects in the room and dissolving that, creates for me a closer connection and interaction with all of space. And for me, it opens everything up. And and I don't know if it had anything to do with the exercise.
The exercise has to do with your experience, so the experience, your experience has to do with the exercise.
So it's all connected.
I would just say one thing, maybe, Sudhaba. The dissolving and expanding, you could maybe try doing that without letting go of the embodied presence. It's a dissolving and expanding without having to be a dissolution. I mean, it's a kind of special kind of dissolving, I guess. And what I was actually thinking of as you spoke is a passage in the Vimalakirti Nirdesha Sutra, which is the text that down at Mangalam Research Center in Berkeley we were working with this summer. And you find this in a number of Buddhist texts, Mahayana texts, that there's a point where Vimalakirti performs a kind of a miracle, I guess, and the way they describe it, they say he took this other realm and he brought it into this realm, but he didn't make this realm bigger and he didn't make that realm smaller. That's what I thought of when you were speaking. So, it's lunchtime. I was going to suggest that you want to experiment with this. You don't have to, because people have kind of been adopting this locution of the speaker, and that's fine. You can stay with that. Something that I think sometimes works well is to keep using the word I, but drop the first person verb so that you would say, I is hungry.
Yeah, I is hungry.
I is hungry, right. Mm. So you might want to try that at lunch.
Me hungry.
My stomach is really.
And is anybody going
to... Oh, yeah, the 130?
The Dharma Publishing, or I'm sorry, the press. Yeah.
At 1:30?
Hmm? At 1:30. Yeah, Dharma Publishing. The bookstore, I'm, you know. Okay, never mind.
No.
It's a special day, isn't it? So.
Well, the Tibetan text production is Yeshe Day. It's called Yeshe Day. It's actually called the Yeshe Day Project.